This is Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. On Sunday, January 16th, one of America's most respected military heroes passed away. Charles McGee was 102 years old. At the time of his death, McGee was the oldest living member of the Tuskegee Airmen, the pioneering group of black pilots and crew who battled discrimination at home and Nazi Germany in the skies over Europe. Escorting U.S. bombers out of Italy to locations all over Europe, the Tuskegee Airmen successfully protected every bomber they were assigned to. McGee served in three different wars, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam, over three decades in uniform, and he flew a staggering total of 409 missions over those conflicts. He retired as a colonel, but in 2020, Congress and President Trump acted to promote him to Brigadier General. This interview took place in early 2019, when McGee still held the rank of colonel. And I began by asking McGee about his growing up years in the Midwest.
I was born in Cleveland, Ohio, but left there in third grade time, and my dad's work moved him to Illinois through my first year of high school, then had 2.5 wonderful high school years in Iowa, and then back to Illinois.
What type of work did your father do?
He was a minister in the AME church and also a social worker.
Okay.
And he also served in the war as a chaplain.
Now, when you say you moved from Iowa back to Illinois, that was for college, correct?
My last less than a half year of high school, then college.
University of Illinois.
University of Illinois, because state schools were cheaper in those days. I probably still a bit, but I was able to work a year after graduating from high school and have enough money to enter my first year of college.
And you joined the ROTC there, is that correct?
ROTC was, yes, indeed. Learned to handle a rifle, and became a member of Pershing Rifles, so it was good training.
Now, at this point, had you had any interest or even experience with flying?
I had not. In fact, folks ask me now, how'd you get into flying? I literally have to say I was avoiding the draft. As I say, I learned to handle a rifle in ROTC. Because I was in school, however, my draft board wasn't pulling my number. And it turns out that when the opportunity for blacks to get into aviation came about, it turns out that the Army had said that they couldn't use any black pilots because they didn't have any black mechanics. So of the now called Tuskegee Airmen, mechanics training took place at Chanute Field, Rantoul, Illinois. That's 14 miles from the university. And of course, we in the community heard, oh, there are blacks in training up at Chanute Field, found out what it was for. I assume my ROTC instructor said, well, you ought to be a pilot rather than a mechanic. And I went and passed the pilot exams, and sure enough, he was right, because after I got in and got my first flight, I knew I'd made the right decision. But that's why I can say I was avoiding the draft.
Well, talk about that excitement. It sounds like there was quite a buzz when you found out the type of opportunity that was available.
Well, that's true, because there wasn't a lot of publicity on it. And of course, I can understand the Army wasn't publicizing, because they said it was that first authorization of a squadron, the 99th Pursuit Squadron, they expected it to fail, because they say, hey, we've studied the issue of going back to 1925 studies, and we know it's not going to be successful. But the pressure's on, we'll experiment. The mechanics did well. They expect them to fail. They didn't. And then they said, wow, we need an airfield for the pilot training. Airfields all around the country, but again, because of segregation, they found $4 million to build Tuskegee Army Airfield. Tuskegee relationship has to do with Tuskegee Institute, which was adjacent to the city of Tuskegee, Alabama. And as they built the airfield about 7 miles northwest of Tuskegee Institute location.
Let's back up just a tad and go to December 7th, 1941. That's a memorable day for you for two reasons.
Oh, my goodness.
It was your birthday.
Birthday for sure. Yeah, I can't forget that indeed. So it's a memorable day. And I can remember at that time, although I was in school, my dad was in Gary, Indiana. I was home for a bit and was with the Glee Club going to a program in South Chicago when it came over the radio with the president announcing the attack on Pearl Harbor.
So you're 22 years old. What are you thinking?
Oh my goodness. Well, that on that date I was 21, and certainly, well, the country had come out of 10 years of depression, although it didn't change segregation. Everybody was interested in the jobs that became available in the war buildups and enlistments and all, so there was a focus on what was taking place.
Did you feel any sense of, I want to be part of the response to this attack?
Well, at that time, and as I look back, I hadn't made a decision where or what, but knew needed to be some part of it somewhere or another. And of course, at that time, getting completing the education was the focus, and that's why I was in school. But after I had met the standards for getting into flight school, I was called into service. I had just finished two years of college.
So when were you called into flight school?
I graduated from flight training June of 43, so October of 42 would be the correct reporting time. Direct into training, and I'm assuming because of my ROTC, I wasn't sent off to a training school first.
What was it like when you got to Tuskegee?
Well, that was quite an experience to go south. Of course, on the train leaving Illinois, when we crossed the Mason-Dixon line, we had to go to a special car that kept races separated. And fortunately, in the training program, we had a number of cadets who were from the south and familiar, and they kept those of us from the north. They let us know where not to go buy gasoline or that type of thing to keep us out of trouble, because it did exist places you just didn't want to go or subject yourself to what might happen if you looked the wrong way or did the wrong thing. And so it was quite an experience.
How did you deal with that?
Well, the focus was on getting those wings and let that go by. In other words, not focusing on just being fully aware and being careful of what you did or how you acted. Of course, my own growing up, I always felt, whatever the circumstance, treat other folks like I wanted to be treated, and that was kind of the direction to go. And of course, the focus on the training, that became important, and the other things were not primary.
How focused were you and the other recruits on proving yourself that you could do this?
Yeah. Well, actually, I don't know that our focus was quite that much. I think the majority of them were for folks who, as a youngster, either had a ride or saw an airplane and wanted to become a pilot. I didn't have that aspiration, but I did want to serve. And fortunately, it came out after that first flight. I've always said I knew I made the right decision because I fell in love with aviation. To be able to go up and loop, roll, and spin, come back and put your feet on the ground. And after looking over the countryside, I don't know what better could replace.
It was instantaneous.
Exactly.
We've heard about how difficult and rigorous the training was there. How would you describe it?
And looking back and looking out, fortunately, they didn't change the standard, and we had excellent training. We had enough folks, and of course, our instructors in the Army training program were, of course, white. They weren't there to change segregation, but they were interested in aviation and passing on. And so under the Southeast Flying Training Command, we had excellent instruction, and the standards weren't changed, and we were able to meet them. So you might say that as you look back on the whole thing, once given the opportunity, we just dispelled the biases and generalization and thought some racist thoughts that because of happenstance of birth, we were less than a full citizen, and those physically qualified but mentally and morally inferior to the white man, we dispelled those things once given the opportunity.
Did the white officers treat you well?
Very well. We had only a few occasions, and more problems came where somebody, when things weren't right, you know, would cuss or use something like that. There were some little things like that, but by and large, none of that deterred the progress and training that took place. And fortunately, well, the first white commander of Tuskegee Army Airfield was kind of interested in keeping segregation. He didn't want a white person from Tuskegee coming out the air base, but a black man at the gate with a gun on. But fortunately, I don't know whether you might say, all I can say now, maybe his inabilities to do what was required at that time, but he was changed, and the commander that Noel Parrish that took his place didn't change segregation, but he fought for the opportunity.
Just a minute before we have to take a break here, when were you deployed to Europe?
I have to say, I graduated in June of 43. The four fighter squadrons were fully formed. We did our combat preparation in Michigan, Oscoda Army Air Base, and Selfridge Field, Michigan. Oscoda, we could do our gunnery out over the lake. December of 43, we were combat ready, left training site, ended up in Italy in January of 1944. That's part of the unit because the first squadron that was formed, the 99th squadron, was already in combat. They were combat ready in December of 42, and were finally sent to North Africa in spring of 43, attached to white groups but still segregated overseas, and that lasted until their segregated assignments were ended in July of 44, when they were then assigned to the 332nd Fighter Group, who had, by that time had gotten into the escort program. And so the 332nd Fighter Group had four squadrons from early July 44 on through to just before the war ended.
In just a moment, more of General McGee's historic and inspiring career as we honor the life and legacy of legendary Tuskegee Airman Charles McGee. I'm Greg Corumbus, and this is Veterans Chronicles. This is Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. Today we are honoring the life of Tuskegee Airman Charles McGee, a veteran of three wars and more than 400 missions in his career of more than 30 years in the U.S. Air Force. General McGee died January 16th at the age of 102, and we are highlighting our 2019 conversation with this remarkable man. As we pick up his story and prepare to hear about his time in combat, General McGee explains the evolution of the aircraft the Tuskegee Airmen would fly.
All of the four single-engine fighter squadrons that are part of the Tuskegee program first flew the P-40 Warhawk. Only the 99th Squadron flew it in combat, North Africa, Sicily, and into Italy. The 332nd Fighter Group, following them, we were combat ready in the P-40, and then they changed and said, oh, you're going to do patrol work. And we changed to got checked out in P-39 Bell Air Cobra. It didn't take but a few hours to maintain the readiness level, and we still left the States in December, our training site, Christmas of 43, to go overseas.
What was that first mission like? You do all this training, but now you actually have to do it. What's it like?
Well, it was a combination. I say training was good because we started out in primary training, 250 horsepower, basic training, 450, and then up to 650 for advanced training, and then jump up into the high thrust of a P-40 after that. So it was a stepping stone, and as I say, training prepared us well for that change. It turns out that, however, the aircraft are quite different. P-39 just wasn't an interceptor. Had a cannon through the, that was the one that had the engine behind, because they had a cannon in the nose, and but not an interceptor aircraft, no speed, no high altitude capability. It turns out that in the spring of 44, we were all with 12th Tactical Air Force. We were the group was patrolling Naples Harbor and the waterways, the Anzio Beachhead. 99th, still flying the P-40, was attached to 79th Group in the ground and interdiction work during the Anzio Beachhead time frame. Shot down German aircraft like the other squadrons because of the opportunity. But the group was one of four picked. We thought we had enough guns on our B-17s and B-24s to protect them from the German Air Force. That wasn't the case. Sometime half the squadron was lost. Well, for every plane loss, that's 10 American lives. And so they pulled four groups from 12th Tactical Air Force to move to 15th Strategic Air Force and begin escorting our B-17s and B-24s. 332nd Fighter Group was one of the four.
Did you have a relationship with a particular bomber squad, so you worked with the same bomber group all the time, or did it rotate?
You never knew. Our operations people who got the orders and helped plan the flights and so on knew the group, but as a pilot, I was never given the number of the group we would escort, and sometimes it could be more than one, depending on how many bombers were on that particular target run and time frame as well to meet up with them and be able to carry them over the highly defended area and help get them back safely from the highly defended areas. So it was an interesting bit of operation, but you never knew. Sometimes there were many groups in it, sometimes it might be just one.
How would you describe the formation? What was the strategy for successfully guiding them to their target and back? Yeah.
Well, so, of course, the first success is being sure to meet them at the rendezvous point and being able, and of course, I like to be in the fighter because once they got on the bomb run, regardless of the ground fire, the bombers had to ride it out to put bombs on target. We and the fighters could still protect them and watch over them, but we could get higher above them, out from them, so on. We could move around. We knew the level of the flak. We didn't have to fly down in the flak blanket unless we were dispatched to go try to help one if one was falling out of formation or something like that. Then we would dispatch elements to help protect them as long as we had fuel and help them get back to a safe area to get back home.
How would you describe the intensity of the resistance, both either in terms of other pilots from the Germans or the ground flak?
Well, they were both difficult to face, if you will, because you never knew how many. But fortunately, as our bombers destroyed Germany's war-making potential, we rapidly reduced that threat, which helped us bring about a victory there. But I appreciated being a pilot because, like I say, we could see where the high fire was and we could still do our job but move about, get a little bit higher, but still do our job to protect the bombers, and for them to, once they got on the bomb run, to have to ride it out. And of course, there were still some losses, but that wasn't what we could control. Certainly, and then coming off of the target, we stayed with the bombers as long as we had adequate fuel to do it. And if there were stragglers, we would dispatch an element to stay with them as long as they could till they got in a safe area. So it was quite a task, but we were well prepared for it and had great leadership in that task. And yet somebody might ask the question, well, the 332nd was called and now called the Red Tails. Folks often, well, I'm sure there are a lot of war stories about it, but 15th Air Force realized when they called on or established the escorts that the gunners need to know that these planes showing up weren't German. And of the four groups picked to start that escort work, one was designated Yellow Tail, one had candy stripe, red and white, one had black and orange checkerboard, 332nd Red Tail. That's where that came about. And of course, the story has been said and part of the research history that although many bomb groups didn't know Red Tails were black pilots, they were glad to have the Red Tail escorts show up because of the nature of our leadership and insistence that we stick with the bombers as long as we could.
So they knew that you were high quality based on your reputation, but they never actually met you.
That's right. Many of them, some groups didn't know even too well after war that the Red Tails were black pilots. There were some that, in fact, in one case, some bad weather had a couple of the squadrons even landed our field, and they were kept for till the weather allowed them to get on to their base, and they learned. But we had, as I say, the segregation overseas. The officers rest camp was on the Isle of Capri. We didn't get there. Mm-hmm. We had a villa up on the hill in Naples because of segregation, but that didn't deter us from. Because we were, as I say, had good leadership, had good training, and many, like myself, we were happy to be there doing the job.
You're very active in talking about the work of the Tuskegee Airmen and many different military events over many years. What was it like to finally meet some of these bomber crews who you helped to shepherd safely?
You know, it's quite a feeling to have someone come up to you and tell you, say thank you, because my father made it back home because of what you did. That's very touching. But realizing training paid off and we were there at the right time and did the right job. And then the value lessons that helped us get through are still good for the young folks today. So that's still a part of the message as we look to keep our Air Force strong and healthy and capable.
We'll be right back with our special remembrance of General Charles McGee. I'm Greg Corumbus, and this is Veterans Chronicles. You're listening to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. In 2019, I had the honor of sitting down with legendary Tuskegee Airman Charles McGee to discuss his legacy of overcoming barriers and serving with excellence during his military career. McGee, who died January 16th at the age of 102, was a retired colonel at the time of our conversation, but a year later would be promoted to Brigadier General by President Trump. As we rejoin our conversation, McGee discusses his confrontation with Germans in the skies over Europe on August 4th, 1944.
We were escorting bombers that had targets at the airfield and a nearby rail marshaling yards were the targets of the day. But it happened that some folk wolves tried to penetrate the bombers we were escorting and happened on the side and where so on that my element was dispatched. And that's the way we did. The lead of the formation would dispatch so everybody didn't turn on them. An element left because the others are still doing their job for the whole bomber stream. But as I turned into the plane, I guess he thought he could dive away, and so I was able to follow, get on his tail, and all I can say is that as we were jinking around is the word we used to avoid, but he made a right turn that put him right in my gun sights, where perhaps had he made a sharp left turn, I wasn't quite in position to fire and down, but fortunately hit the aircraft in a way that destroyed the plane, crashed on the aerodrome.
Wow. What was that like as you Well, or pursuing
so
and
you
succeeding.
Got a job after it. Of course, there was a lot of ground fire from forces on the base. So I just stayed at low altitude, moving away from the base. Also at the same time, and on the way before I started climbing back to altitude, saw a train pulling into a station, and I fired the engine on that train, and of course I immediately continued my climb onto altitude to get back into heading home.
Was that your only pursuit?
That was the only time my element was dispatched for some. We did some fighter sweeps when sometimes with the weather or there weren't bombers or some of the bombers were given other duties and we were free to have a fighter sweep. I think we destroyed more German aircraft on the ground than we did in the air in those fighter sweeps. And then later in the war, there were also they had the P-38 was doing reconnaissance, and that might be only two or four ship go out and escort them going in, because as a single ship with some areas highly defended, certainly they needed it too. So as the war phased down, the element and nature of some of the support changed, but certainly still a real part of helping win the war.
How would you describe the camaraderie at the base?
Wonderful. We had good, developed friendships out of being training together, and in fact, to the point that some folks you only knew them by their nickname. You didn't even know. Well, we'd like to have somebody with Jelly Butt Walker, but I have no idea what his first name was, or something like that. But we were very supportive of each other in that respect, and certainly having gone through training together, it was good to be able to support each other in the combat zone as well.
I also know that you named your plane Kitten.
Yes, that was very popular at that time. Most of the bombers drew pictures on there because they had a lot more space than ours, but I ended up, my wife's name was Kitten, so I put Kitten on mine. But I also liked that because I said my crew chief kept that engine purring like a kitten, so keep it there.
So later in 1944, they brought you back home.
Indeed, in November '44, I finally had a replacement come in, came back, and where was the assignment after rest camp, Tuskegee. When I graduated in June of '43, my instructor had said, too bad they don't have a bomber program for you guys, because I think you'd make a good bomber pilot. Well, I didn't ask him what he meant, but he didn't know they had already approved, and 3 months later, medium bomber training started in the Mitchell B-25 at Tuskegee. And although I'm a single-engine fighter pilot, I became a twin-engine instructor and instructed many of the pilots that became a part of the 477th Bomb Group medium. They didn't get into combat, but fought battle against racism here at home in their training. So much a part of the... So now, Red Tails are the folks that got into combat, but the bomber pilots are those that fought segregation too. Colonel Selway wanted to keep segregation, although Army regulations had already been written, said there should be no further segregation based on race, creed, or color. And but he had General Hunter's okay to say that on his base, trainees could only use a facility designated. And the purpose was they didn't want black officers going to the club because of whites in the club, so he named that a white club. No, you can use facility over on the other side of the field. Well, at that time, your club dues were taken out of your pay before you received, so all officers had the right to the club. Peacefully in twos and threes, officers of the 477th Tri-Danner Club were turned away. Colonel Selway asked them to reread his regulation and sign that they would comply. 101 refused and were immediately shipped off from Godman, from Indiana, where they're in training, to Godman Field, Kentucky, put behind guards, barbed wire, dogs. In fact, worse treatment than German prisoners of war at the adjacent Fort Knox. They sent Selway somewhere because they knew he was wrong, but the Army didn't change their policy. I said, well, what do we do? The war is over in Europe. The 332nd is returned. We'll have a composite group. We'll keep two of the B-25 squadrons. We'll reactivate the 99th, 477th, the composite group. Godman Field? Oh, no. We'll open up Lockburn Air Base south of Columbus, Ohio. This is now for 1946 time frame. Now Rickenbacker Air Base. Mm-hmm. But that became a segregated base. When training ended in 46, Tuskegee's closed. Where'd we go? Lockburn Air Base, Columbus, Ohio. 1947, Air Force separated from the ground forces. And there were those, although some still, I'm sure, would like to see segregation continue, but there were those who at that time determined that, they said, we need to use people based on training and experience and where needed, not their happenstance of birth. And we're not getting enough money to keep Lockburn Air Base open, but not be able to assign units as we would need to carry out the mission. We should integrate. They were backed by a very courageous President Harry Truman, who a few months later issued Executive Order 9981 mandating all the services need to integrate. He also issued another at the same time, I believe it was 9980, stating that there should be equal access and equal hiring throughout the federal government. Of course, statements like that against segregation, they're a statement. Integration is the action. It takes time. The Air Force finally closed Lockburn Air Base 1st of July 1949, and those of us there were scattered around the world. So, and although we didn't see it as civil rights action and so on, you might say that the Air Force led our country in equal opportunity for all.
Describe your reaction to all this. You put your lives on the line to defend our country, to help win the war in Europe, and then you come back home and you're treated horribly.
Yeah.
And then 2 years after that, you've got a president who's standing beside you.
Yeah. Well, as I say, there were those that when the war ended were glad to get out and so on. I enjoyed flying and what that the opportunity meant. And they had said there before integration that you need to do something else other than fly. I chose to go out to aircraft maintenance officer school. You know, some went to intelligence or weather, opportunities of their interest. And as I say, there were those who still didn't like the segregated setup and turned away from serving. But because of my enjoyment of flying, I was happy to stay, if you will. And although the only way I put it now, I couldn't have written a script for better opportunities that seemed to come my way. I didn't ask for them. It just seemed to happen. In other words, after my 100 missions in Korea, I said, well, I'm going to go back to the Philippines to enjoy my overseas tour because they had reopened family travel and joined back. Got my first jet experience and commanded the fighter squadron for 2 years, doing something to enjoy. Well, what more could you ask for?
Right.
But then coming home, staff school, more assignments, and because of my maintenance and materiel interests as well as flying, I was I was sent to Minneapolis, but then there a short time, then to headquarters. So, a materiel job in headquarters. So at that time, most of my assignments were all in I call it the heart of America, Richard Gebauer Air Base. Well, it was Grandview Air Base, very early, then became Richard Gebauer, the old Truman Farm area. But assignments that serving in headquarters, but still flying. And I ended up actively flying 27 of my 30 years.
That's phenomenal.
Didn't ask for it. It happened, and I was a happy camper.
Well, you're also a very humble man because you glossed over the fact that you flew over 100 missions in three different wars.
That is true.
World War II, Korea, and Vietnam.
They normally said that they would take pilots out of combat after 50 missions. That didn't apply to us. So I mentioned we flew the P-39 tactical and then a couple of the P-47-51 in the escort work. I ended up with 82 tactical and 54 strategic missions before a replacement showed up, because they still wouldn't assign a white graduate to the 332nd Fighter Group. So I had 136 missions when I came home from Europe. Of course, the standard there in Korea was pulling folks out of combat after 100 missions. There were some that flew maybe two or three more before they were home, but great experience. And then later I said, well, I also had the Cold War experience, but fortunately it was with the Jupiter missile deployment, so another tour in Italy, but again, commanded in the support squadron for a couple of years in that respect. But my flying then was support aircraft, C-47. I flew our youngsters. We're in Italy, but our high school's in France. We had students that I'd fly back and forth or fly up northern Italy for some of our supplies. So as I say, I love flying. And even if they needed an aircraft, not my aircraft, but any aircraft, needed a little test hop after maintenance before it was put back on the line, I made myself available.
You were the man. So tell me about your missions in Korea. What type of missions
Looking at the, I call them the missions in Europe, the Mediterranean theater, air superiority. In other words, clearing the air so the bombers could do their job, if you will. In Korea, interdiction and ground support. I never saw a MiG because they weren't down in the trees where we were. But we were carrying napalm, rockets, and bombs, but supporting the ground effort. And then turns out later when I flew in Vietnam, it was tactical reconnaissance. No weapons. Speed was our defense, but all types of, you know, there's photo, infrared, all types of intelligence gathering equipment for whatever day night check of what the enemy was doing on the ground. So air superiority, interdiction, ground support, reconnaissance, tactical reconnaissance was three of the phases, if you will, of the Air Force mission that I was able to participate in.
It also strikes me, because you mentioned a moment ago that shortly after the end of the Korean War, you were assigned to command a flight squadron. That's a little more than a decade after just being allowed to be in the military. So that's quite a rise.
Looking back on the experience, and that's why I say I feel that I was very fortunate to do well. I'd say two things that I like. I like to fly, and I enjoyed working with people. And I didn't tell somebody that this is what I want to do. It happened, and fortunately, in all cases, turned out well. So it was the stepping stones, if you will, that painted a picture of success for me in a way. And I guess when you look back at it, you can say that it had its elements of understanding that it's not happenstance of birth that's important, but it's your education and training.
I was going to ask you what your keys to good leadership are, given the leadership positions you've held, but I think you just told me.
That's part of it. But one other thing I've always told, and remember, I've talked both to Navy and Air Force units on occasion, But I've said in leadership, you know, everybody has their those they like and those they like. But I say, don't let it show. Everybody in the unit needs to have the same respect from you. So it's all right to have some buddies, but don't let it show in a way that somebody who thinks they're being left out or not recognized, you're not going to get 100% from them. So I'd say if you want 100% from all your people, treat them all alike.
Tell me a little bit more about Vietnam when you were flying reconnaissance missions with no weapons. Yes. Did you ever come under fire?
Oh, yes.
Well, tell me about that. How did you...
In looking at my war experiences, I didn't get a scratch in Europe and all that flying. In Korea, firing on gun emplacements on the hillside that were trying to keep our troops from moving across the valley, I'm firing at the gun emplacement and realize, hey, they're firing back.
Yeah.
My plane got hit out in the wing, and I was able to get my plane back to home base. Of course, it was in the wing, not the cockpit. Had the same thing happen in Vietnam. We were letting down over a targeted area, and plane took a hit, again, fortunately, out in the wing. I couldn't get back to home base, but I was able to get to a safe base and turn the plane over, and we were fortunate there. My weapon system operator was able to pull our film and stuff, and we bummed a ride back to home base, but lost the aircraft.
Does training just kick in at that point? Is your adrenaline going through the roof? What's it like?
That's why I've owned youngsters that where you're scared. That's no, if you're scared, you're in the wrong business. Training, to me, all aspects of operations, with the right training, you just do it. You know what you have to do. We've talked about tail hook landing. Well, you don't practice it, but when I needed to at that base, I was able to do it because I had no idea whether I had enough, brakes or what if other to stay on the runway. So I made a front-end approach landing, only one in my career. But it's something that's part of training. You know you do, you don't practice it, but you know what you need to do. Like I say, with the good training, it comes automatic.
Wow. So you spent over 30 years in service to our country, right?
Yes, just over there.
How would you describe the difference in the attitude towards you by the military and society from the beginning of your service to the end of the service?
To me, it was quite a difference because when I retired from Richards Gabar Air Base, went to work for an industry, and it seemed to me at that time that I'm trying to think of the right words or the best way to state it, that the service experience gave you something in being on time, where the job, doing the job, and so on, that they were looking for. So I was hired very easily to work for a company in real estate and purchasing. Wonderful time, but the aspect of the company leadership was glad to have the regularness, if you will, of the military experience, one way I might put it. So they were looking for us. And fortunately, I was able to participate. And then I think a lot of times it's attitude and circumstance of where you might be. But I was in Kansas City, Missouri, did a lot of work for the city organizations. And in fact, my last paying job, I managed the downtown airport for a couple of years. But that's interesting too, because one day my wife said she'd like to go fishing more often. I said, I don't really need to be punching the clock. And so I turned the airport over to a young man I had hired and took my wife fishing.
Good for you. She deserves it too.
Yes.
At what point did you realize later on how much interest there was in the story of the Tuskegee Airmen?
It took a while, you know. I've been asked sometime about segregation and said, why do I have anything good I can say about segregation? I said, oh, well, I can say one thing good. The fact that we were together from 1941 to 49, lifelong friendships came out of that, in training, in the combat afterward. But there were folks gathering, Chicago, Detroit, here in D.C., L.A., still enjoying that comradeship. So in 1972, we gathered in Detroit and decided to establish Tuskegee Airmen Incorporated, a national organization, three regions. And at that time, as I say, we had gatherings in those, mainly in those four cities, but we organized in three regions and established the organization. One of our members, who later became the first black four-star general, Daniel Chappie James. Our L.A. group decided to have a dinner for him. Well, he died a month after retirement. So that dinner became a memorial program in which we established a scholarship fund. Over the years that fund has grown, that for the last several years, we've been giving $1,500 scholarships, supporting. But the two purposes of the national organization: preserve the history for what it's meant to our country, motivate youth in aviation space career opportunities. And of course, our focus was on minority youth, but not limited, any youth. That's been our purpose over the years since 1972. We've had an annual meeting every year since, an annual gathering in August still. But our numbers, somewhere along the line, one of the boards decided to put a moniker on us, and those of us with the service experience are called documented original Tuskegee Airmen. Because, well, there were some wannabes out there too, and hear folks' stories of what they did in combat or something, find out they weren't, never made it. But so we're now called documented Tuskegee Airmen. Our numbers, certainly of the 355 that got overseas, that are part of the Red Tail story, we're now down to 12. I happen to be the oldest of the 12 that are still living that got into combat.
What's it like to see yourself portrayed in a movie or to receive the Congressional Gold Medal?
Well, some folks say, you know, the honored long overdue. I didn't see it as overdue, but certainly welcome recognition of what we accomplished and what it meant for the country. And as I say, the value lessons that supported us are still good for the young folks today on what they're facing. So to me, it went together good too. And when we speak of the movie, The Red Tail, that George Lucas put out, a lot of people weren't aware, still, many years after the war. So what was done at that time, the changes it brought about the country, the importance of what the value lessons mean for our youth, that's good track to be on for today, and thankful to have been a part of it and still able to share.
What reaction do you get from young people?
Very, very interesting. The best thing that always, to me, is talking to a group, but sometime later, either an air show or something, have a youngster to come up and say they remember what you said and give you a thanks. That makes your day. Keeps you going, and I say, and it keeps me out of the rocking chair.
Well, I remember something you said. It was last fall at our American Valor program, and you and several other of the surviving Tuskegee Airmen were there, and I believe you were specifically asked about your attitudes coming back from the war and still dealing with segregation. Mm-hmm. And I was struck with the lack of bitterness, the mm-hmm. love for your country, regardless of its flaws, and how yeah. you're glad to see the progress that's been made. Mm-hmm. A lot of people would have a different, perhaps lingering frustration. You didn't. Explain why.
Yeah, well, it's hard to say why, but I've always felt that if you give up hope, you're lost already. So don't go that route. And I also tell folks, you know, everywhere you can go, look for the good things. There are bad things out there, but you don't have to look that way. Look at the good side of what's going on and strive to keep it going on. So I think the other thing, when you talk about attitude, someone brought it to my attention that if you put attitude down and then put the numbers where each of those letters is in the alphabet, it spells 100.
Really?
100% if you got the right attitude. So keep it on the 100% side, not something lower at all.
Well, I have to ask you one more question. I hope you're not opposed to me letting our audience know that you're 99 years old.
Well, not at all. I wouldn't be opposed to that, because it's been my good fortune, and folks ask me why or how, I just say life's been a blessing.
As you could clearly hear, Charles McGee had a joy for life and love for America that was infectious. And his story of overcoming discrimination with grace and serving this nation with excellence is an example for all of us to follow. General McGee served more than 30 years in uniform. He fought in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. He flew more than 400 missions in uniform. General Charles McGee passed away peacefully in his sleep on January 16th at the age of 102. I'm Greg Corumbus, and this is Veterans Chronicles.